ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, this is David Rutledge on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. You're in the Philosopher's Zone. Welcome to it. We're talking about racism this week and a compelling new book that looks at how racial regimes perpetuate themselves. Exactly what we mean when we talk about racial regimes is something we're going to get into. But under the microscope this week is the difference between racism as something that individual people harbour in their attitudes, in their psyches, and racism as something far bigger than that, far more deeply woven into our systems of government and education and law enforcement, and a lot harder to resist. Because the thing about systemic racism in the West is that it cuts across all kinds of cultural and political divides. And at a time when it's very easy to point to parts of the world where genuine fascism is breaking out and say, oh, look what they're doing over there on the extreme political right, it pays to remember the ways in which the structures of liberal democracy, of the liberal left, are also part of the racial regime. Well, back in 2021, I spoke with Alana Lenton on the show. Alana is professor in cultural and social analysis at the University of Western Sydney, and at that time, she had just written a book titled Why Race Still Matters. That was a really interesting conversation, and we'll put a link to that episode on the webpage for this episode. Well, needless to say, there's been a lot of water under the bridge since 2021 when it comes to questions of racism, and Alana Lenton is back with a new book titled The New Racial Regime, Recalibrations of White Supremacy. Your book presents a very direct challenge to the idea that in the post-Cold War liberal West, that, you know, the arc of the moral universe is bending towards justice, and we're all moving from the dark old days of racism in the direction of a post-racist society, the idea of upward linear progress. Tell me about why you don't see that happening, and what it is that we get wrong about racism when we think of it as something that will just fade away as people begin to adopt more enlightened or liberal attitudes.
Yeah, that's a really important question, and one that I also, I guess it's a continuing theme. So also in my last book, Why Race Still Matters, that I think we spoke about five years ago.
We did indeed, that's right.
That theme was also there. So, you know, you might ask, why am I returning to this? And I think to an extent you've answered the question that this kind of mythology that we have been very invested in, that the West and, you know, Western civilization moves inexorably towards more progress and to a version of the better life for everybody has been challenged by the realities that we're facing. And I think a lot of the things that have kind of fallen into place for many people in the current conjuncture with genocide, with ICE raids in the United States, with imperialist adventures in Latin America, and you name it, many of those dominoes that have kind of fallen into place for people are just kind of confirmation of things that people who are affected by racism in the everyday have always said. In other words, racism is a permanent structure, not a perennial or a primordial one, not natural one, not something that is inherent in all human beings, which is very much a kind of a liberal approach to understanding racism, but something that's very embedded and built in to the, you know, the modern Western world order. And really, I've been working on these questions since 2004 and my first book, which was called Racism and Anti-Racism in Europe. And I tried there to expose how this view of racism has operated to separate the functioning of what David Theo Goldberg calls the racial state from the views of isolated individuals. So the operations of race as what I've called a technology for the management of human difference, which has the aim really of reproducing and maintaining white supremacy, can sort of keep ticking along even when we have official state policies against racism or, for example, you know, national anti-racism action plans and the like. And I think we can see this in, for example, Australia's system of incarceration of Indigenous people, and the egregious levels, for example, of deaths in custody. I mean, just since the 1st of January this year, five Indigenous people have died in custody. And I think we also have a reality in which ostensible anti-racism and, you know, these kind of commitments by the state can also be used to deny certain people the right to point out racism because we have come to believe in this kind of progress in which we're all kind of going along, you know, on the route to a better future. So in this new book, The New Racial Regime, I discuss a very interesting article by the late philosopher of race, Charles Mills, the notion of what he calls white time. And this concept actually can be found within, you know, under different names within a variety of other people's thinking, particularly in indigenous thought. But what Mills calls the white temporal imaginary leads us to think that there's a sort of a time of racism, which is a time that we all think should be in the past. And so when white liberals are confronted with the realities that I spoke about of state racism, such as, you know, indigenous debts in custody and so on, what they tend to do very often is to respond with a kind of a hand-wringing, you know, but it's the 21st century. Why are we still dealing with this kind of thing? But I think what's really interesting in Mills's thought and in Black radical and indigenous thought is that it's important to think about time not as linear, but as what Hannah Elias calls heterochronic. In other words, you have multiple times that can coexist. And these Western accounts of history, again, as leading towards greater and greater progress, is actually a way of denying the reality that these systems that we've been bequeathed by history continue to rely fundamentally on race as an organizing mechanism. Really an organizing mechanism for the exploitation of people and the extraction from their lands in the aim of maintaining the interests of a hegemonic Western minority. So you can see already in the way that I'm speaking about race here that it goes far beyond individual attitudes and beliefs, but we've become very invested in kind of isolating racism out as these attitudes that will eventually wither away, you know, when people perhaps are better educated or less ignorant.
Yeah, that point you make about time is really, really interesting. I think it's one of the most interesting parts of your book. And I just sort of mentioned that because I don't actually have questions to ask about it in this conversation, but I'm just putting it out there for the listeners because this whole idea of the extremely problematic nature of Western concepts of history and sort of linear time, the you know, linear progress, these are all very, very enlighteningly, can I say, unpacked in your book. I'd like to move on, though, to the figure of Cedric Robinson. He's woven through the book in a very interesting way. Tell us a bit about Cedric Robinson. Who was he and how does his work inform your ideas and arguments?
Yeah, I came to the work of Cedric Robinson around the time that a lot of other people did, sadly very late, so around 2016 when he passed away. And that was the time that more people started talking about his work. But since then, he's become incredibly important for reorienting and shifting the way I think about race. So it's been of enormous value for me to think with Robinson about, you know, my work. So as I said, he died in 2016. He was really a Black radical, but formerly a political scientist, and he was the director for many decades of the Center of Black Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And probably the book that most people have heard of is his book, which is not actually his first book. Many people think that it is, but it was published in 1983. And the title is Black Marxism. But the subtitle of the book is much more important. As many people have pointed out, the title is kind of sometimes misleading because many people think it's a book about Marxism from a Black perspective. But really, the subtitle, which is The Making of the Black Radical Tradition, is really, really what the book is about. What is this Black radical tradition? He also wrote four other very important books and many articles, and especially he gave many lectures, which can now be found in his archives, which have been opened at Santa Barbara and at NYU. And one of the things that he did, for example, was to present a weekly radio show with his wife, Elizabeth Robinson, and all that can be found in the archives. So I'm looking forward to an opportunity to get in there. So during his life, he was a very special person. He really cultivated a space for his students and members of the community to engage in deep study of this Black radical tradition, which his biographer, Joshua Myers, in a brilliant book about Robinson's life, says that this Black radical tradition emanates from thought that is unthinkable, which I think is a really crucial way of thinking about. So what kind of ways of thinking were not permissible within formal structures of education and in public life? And he tried to really push against that. So Robinson, for example, through his deep excavation of Western narratives, that produced racial blackness as a means to expand Western power. And he saw this as happening, you know, through nationalism, through colonialism, through slavery, and through imperialism. What he does, what he's focused on, is troubling Western certainties. So things like order. His first book is called The Terms of Order, and he returns to this theme of order all the time, authority and rationality.
And he coins this phrase, racial regimes. I don't know if he's coined the phrase, but he certainly, it looms large in his work. What does he mean by racial regimes?
In Robinson, the idea of racial regimes is really, it comes from his last book. And this is a book that apparently he worked on for 20 years. And it's called Forgeries of Memory and Meaning. And this is a book really about the racialization of black people in and through the U.S. film industry. And that's really, really interesting. In fact, he starts with theater. He looks at sort of Shakespearean theater, the representation of black people. But then he kind of jumps forward to the beginning of the 20th century when you see this kind of nascent U.S. film industry. And he looks at film in relation to capitalism and in relation to race and imperialism in that book. So all of these kind of three things are constantly in a sort of triangular relationship, which is so interesting. So he defines racial regimes as constructed social systems in which race is produced as a justification for relations of power. And he talks about them as really, or at least my interpretation of it, is a set of representational mythologies that are really based on the idea, which is very prevalent, something that we've, you know, challenged a lot, but which I think still exists, that somehow racial difference is natural. And this idea of natural occurring difference is then used in order to rationalize the exploitation of black people, and that this rationalization is integral to capitalism and to imperialism. So to come back to the US film industry, what he's saying is that the representation of black and colonized and indigenous peoples, but his focus is on black people at this time through cinema, justifies the US's imperial ambitions, but also its exploitation of black people within the US economy at a time when you had to cohere a new sense of nationalism that didn't really exist in the US. So a time when, you know, as, you know, people spoke about how the Irish became white, Noel Ignatieff, for example, how Jews became white folk, Karen Brodkin, etc. You know, again, how we've seen similar processes in this country where groups formerly thought of as non-white within the white Australia policy were kind of folded into the white nation for the purposes of shoring up white power against indigenous people. Very similar processes, obviously, in the US. And cinema plays a very, very important role in this through the representation of black people in very particular ways. So what I personally took from Robinson, because obviously he gives us this germ of the idea, and my book is obviously not about cinema, so, you know, where was I going with this? So what I took from it is this idea that he talks about in the preface of the racial regime as not a static thing. This is why he talks about a new racial regime cohering at this time, which he says is stitched together from old cloth and new. He uses a lot of these stitching metaphors, which I love. And therefore, he's saying this regime is in a process of recalibration, which is a constant process. But recalibration is different to revolution or wholesale change. It's, if you think about it visually, it's like little small changes, you know, like very minute often, right? But these changes or these recalibrations have to happen because there's always opposition from below. From those who are affected by this, because, you know, people are not going to stand still and say, yeah, sure, you know, represent me in this way, treat me in that way. They're not going to accept it. So they're always pushing back. And so therefore, Robinson says that racial regimes have to do a lot of work to hide what he calls their mechanisms of assembly. And they appear, again, this idea I spoke of before, they appear to be natural, or they propose race or racial differences to be natural and therefore historyless, right? Just always there, just a kind of a universal feature. But what he says is that they do have a history obviously they're not natural. And so our task, and this is what I took from him, sort of the inspiration, is to expose those mechanisms of assembly and to look at the history and look at how things are recalibrated and try to lay them out, right? That's what we're interested in. In the preface, he talks about race being a very chaotic manufacturer. It's not a totalizing system in a kind of Foucauldian sense. It actually is assembled from various, you know, mythologies and bits of history, and, you know, it relies on Christianity, motifs of Christianity, motifs, you know, arguments about geography and skin color and all these kinds of things. And they're all kind of put into a grab bag, and it's whatever works, right? So that's, but tracking that, because again, just to reiterate, there is a process, but tracking that can be very confusing.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, I'm David Rutledge. This is The Philosopher's Zone, and my guest this week is Alana Lenton, a scholar at the University of Western Sydney and the author of a brand new book, The New Racial Regime, Recalibrations of White Supremacy. One of the projects of exposure of the histories, the social relations at work in racial regimes, of course, is critical race theory. And you write about the contemporary panic over critical race theory as a sort of diagnostic moment in your book. And until I read your book, I mean, I think I was like a lot of people, when I thought about critical race theory, I tended to think of people in the USA like Chris Rufo and Ron DeSantis and, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, people on the political right who have attacked critical race theory from the right in ways that are completely unsurprising. But you're writing about critical race theory as something that also raises anxieties about race and history and power on the liberal left. So how does that happen? How does the critical race theory debate expose those anxieties and expose the contradictions within liberalism when it comes to race and racism?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting, isn't it, that we think about critical race theory and then we think about all of these right-wing figures who attacked it rather than having very much knowledge actually of what critical race theory is. Because if you kind of swing back all the way, you know, we remember 2020, the tail end of Trump's first presidency, I hope, you know, maybe you don't remember. This was the thing that caused me to want to write the book, right? Suddenly I saw that Donald Trump is talking about critical race theory, which for us as scholars of race is a relatively marginal and very particular kind of approach to the study of race. And so why are these people, as you said, Christopher Rufo, why are they talking about critical race theory? And Donald Trump signs an executive order at the end of his term banning the use of critical race theory. Now, just a short potted history of how that happened, which I deal with in the book, is interesting. So this character, Christopher Rufo, who's a kind of a right-wing activist, if you like, made it his business to look at the training manuals, I guess, the diversity, equity, and inclusion training manuals that were being used in Seattle. And he saw that in the footnotes of these manuals, there are references to critical race theory and to critical race theorists, such as the two main ones he focused on were Kimberly Crenshaw, who sometimes is known better for her coinage of the term intersectionality, and Ibram X. Kendi, who's actually not a critical race theorist as such. He's a historian of race in the United States, I would say more correctly. And he kind of became, I suppose, well known in the context of the George Floyd uprisings when he wrote about, you know, what it means to be an anti-racist. I think his book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. And he came, you know, under fire from many of these right-wing figures. But anyway, so this was really what, as I said, instigated me to write this book. And originally I wanted to write a short kind of essay-like response to this war on critical race theory. And it was relatively interesting because quite a lot of, and this tallies with a question about racial regimes, is that quite a few people said to me, well, you know, this will all blow over. It's a storm in a teacup. And from the perspectives of understanding the recalibration of the racial regime, you understand that that's not the case. And in fact, fast forward to Donald Trump's second presidency, of course, he's doubled down on the banning of books, on the teaching of African American history, on the, you know, the banning of books in public libraries. And this has been mirrored in many other places around the world. Okay. And, you know, you mentioned Ron DeSantis is the governor of Florida. Of course, he really took it upon himself to make this, you know, an enormous part of his policy. He's also very much opposed to the teaching of gender studies or any kind of mention of gender and sexuality across public life in Florida. And it's actually, as we know, very dangerous for example, transgender people in Texas, in Florida, in these places under these regimes. But the reason I was interested in is an observation that I was making that's also backed by one of Cedric Robinson's students, the Black radical historian, Robin D.G. Kelly, who said that this war on critical race theory and also the war on woke, if we remember that, is an example of the functioning of the racial regime. And I thought that's really very true. So I wanted to look into it. But where it led me was to think critically about critical race theory itself, because one of the things that many people said in response to this war on critical race theory and this hysteria, you know, we had Pauline Hanson, for example, talking about banning critical race theory in Australia, even though really it's hardly taught anywhere at all in the entire Australian, you know, higher education, let alone school system. So one of the responses that was made to this right-wing attack was to try to kind of minimize the role that critical race theory has. I mean, it's true. I just said it. It's not widely taught. And even in the United States, critical race theory is a very specific approach. But I don't think that that's a very adequate response, because there wouldn't be so much done to outlaw it, to ban it, and to make it this boogeyman figure if it didn't actually have a serious critique of, you know, white supremacist systems. So I was fascinated by the tendency to talk about it as a moral panic or as part of the culture wars. In a sense, I felt that minimized actually what the debate is here, right, which is about being able to overturn received knowledge or white knowledge within public life, which was something that was begun, I think, during, you know, what was named the racial reckoning of 2020, really the global movement for Black lives and against the violation of Black life, which we saw also very important iterations of here in Australia. That is minimized, I think, if you just talk about it in terms of a culture war. But again, there's a confusion about what critical race theory is. So in the book, I tried to return to that. It's important to note that it actually originates in critical legal theory in the 1980s. And the critique from Black scholars at this point in the United States that whereas critical legal theory was mounting important, I guess, Marxist-inflected challenges to the US legal system, they weren't taking race into account. And they wanted to do that. So that's where it begins. The kind of problem is, I think, and this is a little bit, you know, maybe of particular interest to scholars, but I think it's relevant, is that critical race theory has been used interchangeably for general studies of race. And that kind of leads us to lose sight of its history. And when we look back into its origins and its history and what it was actually set out to do, that's when we can start to think of a critique from a left perspective. I wouldn't say this is a liberal perspective. I think this is a more of a left perspective on what critical race theory actually does. So, for example, one of the best papers I've read on, you know, what is critical race theory is by the Black philosopher Tommy Curry, and I speak about in the book. And he says that critical race theory, its role is to challenge what he calls the reality and unchanging nature of racism in America. And Derrick Bell, in fact, the founder of critical race theory, he was a Black professor at Harvard at the time, talks about racism as being permanent in the United States. And Curry doesn't think, controversially, that you can extend critical race theory or use it interchangeably for other approaches to studying race. And particularly, he doesn't think a decolonial approach is compatible with a critical race theory approach. He says the role of critical race theory is basically to challenge and to undo white supremacy within the US by focusing specifically on how it operates, how race operates within the legal system. So notwithstanding this, you know, critical race theory has been extended in really useful ways. For example, by indigenous theorists, we have tribal crit, you know, trying to look at kind of race from an indigenous perspective, and various things. But that doesn't kind of get us over this problem of the foundational orientation of critical race theory and what it might miss. So what I was interested specifically was how certain understandings of critical race theory actually make themselves available for the recalibration of the racial regime. And this is because of certain things that are left out of the story of what critical race theory is, because we tend to use it, just to repeat that, we tend to use it interchangeably for just being generally interested in critiquing racial systems. And particularly in the book, I focus on the fact that foundational critical race theorists tended to elide or to leave out colonialism, but also imperialism in their focus. And what this ends up doing is it makes it quite easy to separate between a view of racism, which I think more of us are comfortable with or familiar with, which is a set of, you know, discrete local problems, usually to do with discrimination. So, you know, we would think about the gap in life expectancy between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, or we think about workplace racism, for example. And so that's kind of separated off from the global orders, which actually produces these inequalities, right? So this kind of system in which kind of race coheres, and that separation ends up being relatively useful in order to say, for example, just to make it very practical from an institution's point of view, look, we're dealing with racism. We're looking at how these people are discriminated against, and we're trying to hire more people of color, for example. But that kind of leaves the entire system intact, right? It doesn't really think about, you know, what is producing and reproducing these same kinds of inequalities over generations. So, you know, current events, I think, really point clearly to the fact that it's really difficult to try to separate between these things when we get down to the nitty-gritty of it. And that's kind of the beauty of beauty is not really a good word, but the the utility, let's say, of thinking about race as a technology. So having a function to reproduce a racial order rather than just being a set of either discriminatory policies or, again, attitudes that individuals have, right? So think about some things that are going on in the world that I already mentioned, ICE raids in the United States that many people are focused on. How do we separate those local attacks on migrants, undocumented people within the United States, from the US's imperialist ambitions in Latin America that we saw with the recent, basically the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela? And again, how do we separate between that and the US's support wholesale for the genocide in Palestine, right? These things are not really extricable from each other. And it's not just because of the well-established links between, for example, the IDF and, you know, U.S. police. So we know that there's training, kind of cross-training that happens. The IDF trains the United States police and vice versa. And the imbrication of weapons manufacturers and technology manufacturers and the kind of the global flow of these things. Anthony Lowenstein has written very well about this. But also because the genocide in Palestine, for example, isn't just a local conflict, but my argument and the argument of many people who focus on imperialism is that it really plays a key role in the maintenance of Western hegemony. In many ways, I think we can understand Zionism and Israel as the tip of the spear of this project rather than being an outlier. And then we start to think about, well, we can't, again, to come back to my example, separate out the US's ambitions to, you know, dominate in an imperialist sense from its use of, let's say, Israeli-generated technology in order to surveil and punish migrants on the ground. So I was interested, therefore, in why it is the critical race theory tries to stay very much in its own lane, if you know what I mean, and what this means when certain critical race theorists fail to name these connections. And I try to, I guess, de-individualize my critique. So I'm not really interested in saying, oh, why did so-and-so not speak out about X and Y problem? And I try to say that it's not just because people are fearful of speaking out, although that definitely exists, but that there are epistemic reasons to do with the decentering of colonialism and imperialism from critical race theory that sometimes makes it unavailable for making these connections and critiques. And that therefore, you know, so then when we come back to what is the war on critical race theory, it's not enough just to say, well, you know, we need more critical race theory. Yes, we do. Neither is it enough to say, don't worry, critical race theory doesn't pose a threat. We need to actually interrogate our own tools in order to perfect them, in order to be able to mount a better challenge to, again, to the recalibration of the racial regime.
I guess the popular understanding of critical race theory, or maybe not the popular understanding, but maybe a less critical understanding, is one that sees it as sort of functioning by exposing some of those hidden sort of recalibration processes that we were talking about earlier within the racial regime. Looking at ways in which liberalism has a lot to say about things like diversity and equity and representation, but not much to say about deeper questions that have to do with you know, power and property and land, reparations, all the unfinished business of colonialism. And as an example of this, I want to ask you about universities and academia, because you will never find a more eloquent statement of commitment to fairness and inclusion than on the website of a major university. If we look a little deeper, what do we discover about universities and how they, as you put it, help to recalibrate those underlying structures of white dominance and leave them intact?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was really interested in this book was thinking about those apparent paradoxes, because if you think about Robinson's insistence that the construction of race historically is a chaotic construction, right? It's not something that's very clear and linear, and it relies on a whole host of ideas, often contradictory ones, right? So this is not a new process, is something that I think is important to say. But I think there has been an effort, so I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, there has been an effort on the part of institutions to try to redress institutional complicity in, you know, not only racial discrimination, but also indigenous disadvantage, yes, but also the role that universities have in perpetuating the racial ideas that are so fundamental to the establishment and maintenance of colonialism. So there have been various truth-telling processes within various universities, not only here, also in Canada and elsewhere. South Africa has been an important locus for this, and so on. You have had important processes happening in Britain, particularly around 2018, 2019, that have led to, you know, the removal of colonial statues or memorials to slaveholders, and a work that universities have tried to do to address their complicity and to a certain extent to redress. So there have been certain reparations that have been paid by institutions in the United States to the descendants of enslaved people and so on. So again, it's important to say that these processes have happened, but they've happened, obviously, I think, in reaction to or in response to the sustained critique from Black and Indigenous people over decades, right? So this is not new, but it became necessary at a point where there was global outrage. So I'm talking about after the murder of George Floyd in 2020, although, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement had already existed over the course of the previous decade, but it became uncontainable at this point and something had to be addressed. And at this point that you have, I mean, you know, the critical response to that would be from a book I cite. Well, I don't cite the book. I cite the original article on which it's based by Two Black and Rasul Mowat, who talk about the laundering of Black rage. So this rage, this justifiable rage that, you know, burst out in reaction to the murder of George Floyd was quite quickly repackaged into this moment that became known as the racial reckoning, when you had this, you know, sale of anti-racist books, and you had multiple panels, and you had, I talked about Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, taking the knee, and you had police taking the knee, and all this kind of thing. And, you know, I think people thought that the tables were turning, and very quickly you had the backlash of the war on critical race theory and everything that has kind of flowed on from then, and a real resiling in many quarters from those commitments, you know, all of those, you know, diversity quotas that were put into place. You know, I know from my own, you know, field of work and within universities, Black studies programs, you know, being set up and being disestablished almost immediately within, you know, a few years, Black hires again being let go, and so on and so forth. So, you know, these are things that are very important to point out. But beyond these kinds of measures, I think what we need to think about, so when universities, for example, say they're engaged in work around indigenizing and decolonizing, as you said yourself, what's left out of the picture? Where is the question of land, which on this continent is the all-important question when it comes to sovereignty? How do we indigenize and how do we decolonize in a colony, a still active colony, one where there are no treaties apart from the new treaty in Victoria between the colonizers and the indigenous peoples? And I thought it was very interesting. I mean, just as a very small snapshot of this, I quoted from Taylor Miller, who's a scholar at the University of Arizona. And she says, you know, yes, for example, land acknowledgements, or what we would call here acknowledgements of country, are important. But what does it mean today when every email footer has a land acknowledgement? And she said it was even that land acknowledgement at the University of Arizona was even on the email that they sent me. I'm quoting from her. So she says it's included in every email, including the email that I received when they said, "We're deploying chemical munitions on your students." So obviously she was talking about when the student encampment was being attacked by police in 2024, and we saw similar things happening in many different locations. So I'm always interested to know, I guess, what commitments by universities to indigenization, decolonization, or even self-determination, what that papers over, what it leaves unsaid, and what and how, I guess, it conscripts us as anti-racists into a project where we've become accustomed to being, I want to be careful here, because I think there are many, many critical people working in very, very challenging conditions, which are becoming more and more challenging by the day, because we can see that there's a wholesale attack on the university, particularly on the humanities and social sciences from the right. So everybody is beleaguered. But I think at the same time, we have to be very careful about what structures of power we allow to be reproduced by allowing languages that have been developed in struggle to be used in order to recapitulate the sort of the dominance of the university as a site of power, a site which is not extricable from the overall colonial edifice in this continent, but also more widely as a Western project that has been used in order to deem what is reliable knowledge. So whose knowledge is reliable and viable and setting the standard for what knowledge is, and whose knowledge is to be mistrusted, right? The unthinkable, to come back to what I said Robinson was doing with the Black radical tradition, trying to really work with that thinking that was unthinkable and remains unthinkable. So the kind of thought that, you know, the Black radical and the Indigenous radical traditions are trying to mount is thought that, and this again comes back to the war on critical race theory, that's why it wasn't just a moral panic or a figment of the culture war. It really was an attack on these knowledges that when taken, right, really taken and thought about, can lead to wholesale disruption of the system as it is. And that's what we don't want to do, right? That's what those in power don't want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is interesting to me, partly because it's a question that goes to the heart of philosophy and what philosophy is, how it's practiced, the institution of philosophy itself as a colonial project.
Yes.
All sorts of interesting things to talk about there. But if we can bring this back to Zionism, your book frames Zionism as structurally aligned with Western liberal power. But how does that framing account for Zionism's origins as a movement shaped by European marginalization, you know, Western marginalization, exclusion, persecution, and for the ways in which those histories of persecution still shape Israeli politics and Jewish diaspora politics today? It's like there seems like a kind of tension between this idea of Zionism as aligned with Western liberalism, while at the same time being something that was born out of the experience of murderous persecution within Western liberal societies.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's interesting to think about Zionism as being aligned with Western liberalism specifically, because I think that leads us to a question about what we think the connection is between liberalism and fascism. And in the sort of preface or prologue to the book, I quote the black revolutionary thinker, he was incarcerated at the time of his assassination, George Jackson, when he talks about the connection between liberalism and fascism. So these two things are kind of Janus-faced, right? It's very difficult to disentangle the two. And I think one of the stories that we tell ourselves is that Zionism is a liberal movement. And there are people who even talk about Zionism as being an anti-colonial project, and very dominantly, as I talk about in the fourth chapter of the book, even a project to, I guess, resecure Jewish indigeneity to the land, right? So that's very interesting because, of course, it takes directly from the grammars of indigenous peoples in order to constitute a settler colony. So again, these things are very entangled with each other. I think it's important to say that when the founders of Zionism were coming up with the ideology of Zionism, we're talking about the 1860s, although Zionism has a much longer history, it has a longer history in particularly in Christian thought, particularly in Protestantism, right? A much, much longer history that is I haven't been able to go into in the book, but which I hope to be able to do in subsequent work, and very important historical studies have been done on this, which is why it's also important, I think, to somewhat disentangle Zionism from Judaism, but being very careful about this, because I think that's also a convenient sometimes way of looking at things. Oh, there's nothing to see here. This is, you know, only, you know, we can completely separate Zionism from Judaism. But to a certain extent, I think originally we can talk about Zionism hijacking Judaism and also the problem of anti-Semitism, the challenge of anti-Semitism at the time. Because when, and this is uncomfortable, but when you look at the writings of the founders of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, in his, for example, caricature of Mauschel, right, which is the figure of the anti-Zionist Jew, which he opposes to the Zionist Jew in his writing, you would think it was written by somebody coming from very different origins, let's put it that way. He uses anti-Semitic caricature in order to describe this person. And in fact, he appealed to the British and to the French and so on by saying, we'll actually get rid of your Jewish problem for you, okay? Give us the Jews. We'll take them to Palestine. We'll get rid of your Jewish problem for you. And in describing this Jewish problem, again, he uses this very, very racist language about Jewish people. And so the project of Zionism, yes, it tries to deal with anti-Semitism. And of course, that takes on a different tenor after the end of the Second World War. But right from the beginning, Zionism uses racial science and eugenics in order to establish what is very explicitly referred to as a colonial project. I mean, this is not me imposing a presentist language onto Zionism. Zionism and Zionist founders describe their project as a colonialist project. And so therefore, I think we need to listen to Zionists in their own words, right? And really to think what that means when we then try to consider the attempts today to portray it as a liberal movement, right? Or even as an anti-colonialist movement.
I usually finish these interviews with a question or two along the lines of, so what are we going to do about this problem? And one thing that I like about your book is that it steers well clear of solutions in the form of, you know, policy proposals or institutional fixes. You actually call for a willingness to remain in political conflict, to accept a degree of discomfort and polarization and to resist liberal demands for civility. I do wonder, though, about the challenge of building the kinds of broad alliances that are needed to actually make things happen. Like, how do you distinguish between productive political antagonism on one hand, and then on the other hand, the kind of fragmentation that just weakens our collective capacity to challenge power?
I really appreciate your question, but I would like to look at it slightly from the other side. Because I think when we're asked for solutions, what we have in our head, and I'm thinking of somebody who works within institutions, you know, we write these research grant applications, we're always asked to make recommendations, you know, what are you doing to actually change things or to move things along? What we're really being asked to do is to think about how the demands, for example, from my own perspective, anti-racist, anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist demands, can be made fit within a pre-existing liberal order, right? So none of us are, you know, happy with the fascistization of the current conjuncture. We all want to oppose that. I presume, you know, none of us are, you know, in favor of deporting, detaining and violating migrants and killing those who try to defend them. You know, we're all opposed to that. But we think, how can we work within the current order as it stands to perfect it in some kind of way, notwithstanding all the critiques that we've been made? And actually, if you think the unthinkable, to come back to Robinson again, that should be unthinkable. It should be unthinkable to be able to remain within the realm or remain within the order as it's been established and to try to tinker around the edges, which I don't think is what you would be suggesting, but I think that's often where that leads to. And so what I get from Robinson, who in fact is inspired by Marx's essay on the Jewish question, is that we need to reject what he calls the terms of order. We need to think very clearly about what we're being asked to align ourselves with and think about it from the other side. And if we zoom out and we think about the intractable or the seemingly intractable problems that face us from a global perspective, the majority actually agrees and is able to work together. We might have small disagreements about tactics and strategy, but in general terms, we're opposed to genocide, we're opposed to racism, we're opposed to sexism and transphobia, we're opposed to invading countries and shooting migrants, again, to come back to that. We're opposed to that, so we agree. And those who disagree, or those who, for example, would like us to try to work with things as they stand, are ultimately, to a certain extent, coddling power, right? Coddling the status quo, or making the status quo thinkable still, when it should be utterly unthinkable. One of the things that, for example, we could think about with the revelation of the Epstein files is what remains unsaid. What will be the next step after these horrific revelations? Vote for the Democrats? You know, the Democrats are also imbricated in the system, the United States. That is not a satisfactory response to this level of violation of humanity. And I think once we start to think globally and we think about those alignments, so this is not about not working together. Yes, we want to work together, but we want to think the unthinkable and to overturn the current order as it stands.
Alana Lenton, she's Professor in Cultural and Social Analysis at the University of Western Sydney, and her book is The New Racial Regime, Recalibrations of White Supremacy. Publication details on the website. You can listen to this episode again, along with past episodes, on ABC Listen. This has been The Philosopher's Zone, produced on Bundjalung Land by me, David Rutledge, and it's been great to have you along this week. Bye for now.